Quest for Gold. I'm Ryan Burrow. We're counting down the weeks until the 2024 Summer Games in Paris. We start this week in suburban Chicago, not far from where we're based. Simone Biles showed she may have missed a couple years, but she didn't lose a step. Biles, who hasn't competed since pulling out of the Tokyo Games in 2021, won the all-around by 5 full points in the U.S. Classic, scoring her highest score on the vault, which is where she was experiencing those twisties back in 2021.
Everything has fallen into place. I feel really good about where I am right now, mentally and physically. I still think there are some things to work on throughout the night and in my routines, but for the first meet back, I would say it went pretty well. I'm very shocked, surprised, I'm happy. I feel a lot better now that that's out of the way.
The audio courtesy of USA Gymnastics. Now she looks to the U.S. Championships in San Jose later this month and the Worlds in Belgium in October. And at that point, maybe we'll know for sure if we have a 2024 Paris contender suiting up for Team USA.
Right now, I think I should just embrace what happened today, be happy for me, for my teammates. We'll go into championships in a couple of weeks, work on those tweaks that we had today, but I'm in a really good spot. And who knows? I'm not going to think so far ahead. I know everybody, it's just like when you get married, they ask you when you're having a baby. You come to classics, they're asking you about the Olympics. I think we're just trying to take it one step at a time and we'll see.
Well, we saw success on the mat this week, but disappointment on the pitch. The U.S. women's national team fell to Sweden in a heartbreaking round of 16 World Cup penalty kick loss. The team's been bounced from major international competitions before, but never this early. It's got a lot of soccer fans wondering what went wrong, and is there enough time to fix it before Paris, 11 months from now? I had a chance to catch up with Jeff Reuter, soccer writer for The Atlantic, to talk about those issues.
On paper, we go back to July 20th before the World Cup began, and you looked at this roster on paper. And you saw what team the U.S. was going to trot out there. What was your expectation and people inside the soccer circles? Was it that this team is a lock to win the World Cup?
I don't think that there was ever any assumption, both inside the team, inside U.S. soccer, and also just in the general American soccer media landscape, that this was a team that was on just like a clear path towards winning a third consecutive World Cup and a fifth one in program history. That isn't necessarily to say that this was a weak U.S. women's national team roster. I think that there were still tremendous areas of strength. There were players who certainly would play for any team in this field, including the ones which are still playing in the quarterfinals and beyond. It wasn't so much about that. I think it was more about the gains that were made by other national team programs in the world, encouraging girls to start playing soccer at younger ages so that they had more of the technical proficiency, the tactical awareness, these sorts of things, which are so commonplace in men's soccer, but only finally over the last 20 years or so are becoming more common on the women's side of the game as well. There are programs in England, Spain, France, Germany, Japan, Brazil, and not all of these advanced, obviously, further than the United States or even as far as the United States did. But at the same point, there's a longer list of programs that are doing this right, that are building towards having World Cup and Olympic winning caliber national team programs than there ever have been on the women's side of the sport. So I think the expectation would have been semifinal, make it to the Final Four. At that point, you're definitely playing for a medal, so to speak. You're playing to make it to the podium. And it truly is going to be level playing fields in terms of those semifinal matchups and then that final as well. And it really is just executing your game plan better, finishing the chances you have, not making silly mistakes that open up an opponent to make other chances, what have you. But I think that top four finish in this field was a very reasonable, not overly ambitious, still ambitious given the quality of the field, but also given the quality of the United States, something that you could say we would expect to make it to the top four of a Women's World Cup.
So in some regards, this is U.S. men's basketball in the early 2000s, where all of a sudden the rest of the world,
right,
you know, watched a couple cycles and like, hey, that's, you know, right, let's build this up. And now all of a sudden you're struggling against Spain, you're losing to Puerto Rico, you know, that
Argentina,
kind of
right.
Argentina, yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Okay, so the world is caught up. That's good, obviously, for the sport.
Yes.
I felt like watching the coverage, though, and it was interesting. I mean, you get Alexi Lalas's take, you get Carly Lloyd's take. I felt primed to watch this team fall. I don't know why, but I felt like they were setting up that this team didn't have it. There was something missing. And so when it happened, I guess I wasn't incredibly surprised. Were you getting those vibes as well? I know neither of those is necessarily inside the program. You feel that Carly Lloyd's pretty close to the program, but the thing she was saying, it was like, whoa, wait a minute. These are your sisters. You know, you were just playing with them. And now the things you're saying, did you feel that, I mean, maybe the vibe was a little off?
Massively. I felt like Fox's coverage of this tournament almost demanded failure from the United States to actually pay out. So often, I think if you look in a contrast, for example, let's use the 2022 Men's World Cup, which was held in Qatar. And a lot of the same people, including Lexi Lawless and Carly Lloyd, were on that desk as panelists. And of course, the men's national team is always going to carry a very different stigma around them, a different expectation level. We're not talking about semifinals with the U.S. men's national team, right? In any World Cup. So we're comparing two different calibers of teams, right? It's like Jamaica's track team versus the track team from Finland. You're just talking about them in very different ways, right? And I think similarly, 4 years ago, the United States women's national team was expected to win this tournament for a second straight time, and they did. And that coverage plan, as well as the 2022 Men's World Cup coverage plan, were about stars. It was about Lionel Messi. It was about Kylian Mbappe. It was about Carly Lloyd, all centered around the headline players who were most likely to capture the moment, to be the ones who have the iconic photograph taken of them, which lives on for decades and decades and decades in publications and in digital media, what have you. That had been the plan. Something feels very different this time around, like you're alluding to, where they were hoping that it wouldn't end well for the United States. And you can point to ties with the news division of Fox's media enterprise, and you can say, okay, maybe there's some overlap there, some interests in terms of singing the national anthem, in terms of taking knees 4 years ago, things like this, where maybe having the sports division in closer lockstep is a better media strategy, purely from terms of consistency and tone across all of your platforms, right? And that's something where I'm not the expert on media literacy across both news, reactionary, and sports divisions. I think that those sections of the newspaper have always been printed separately and handled often by separate publishers, right? But at the same point, you have a consistent dialogue of things that the critics, that the pundits on Fox's desk did not like, which had very little to do with what was wrong with this team in this tournament, which is not finishing your chances, which is not being clinical in front of goal, which is not controlling game state in a way that was actually fortuitous towards you winning a tournament. It was more about making sure that you never get out of games and then hopefully a lucky bounce breaks your way. Those are criticisms I would expect from great soccer pundits, from a World Cup winner like Carly Lloyd, from a longtime servant of the program since the 1990s like Lexi Lawless. And instead, we're talking about a portion of the country might not support them because of their politics, as if that is the most important thing at a time.
Unlikable was the word, I think, that Lawless used. I don't know what that means, because, you know, in some regards, yeah, unlikable. Like, they've got swagger, and that's what draws a lot of the young girls to this team, is they've got swagger. I don't care what anyone else thinks about them, and they're gonna fight for their money. They're gonna come out with their sunglasses on, you know, and have all the swagger. And if you win, no one cares, right? I mean, that's all part of the bit. But if you lose, I guess it looks bad.
It can, right? And this goes back actually to the Team USA basketball, actually, I think is a very good parallel, because that was a lot of the culture was, okay, they're walking in and they're just assuming they can roll out their B team and their C team and they'll be better than everyone else in the world. This was not the U.S. women's B team. I want to make that clear. But there were key players who were missing, who then other players were played out of position to overcompensate for them. And so there were issues on the field which were requiring them to play as a different version of themselves, not really play to their best, where their on-field excitement, verve, enthusiasm, and execution did not match the off-field swagger, the pageantry around the team, the fitted suits with the lapels that you would never dare wear on the street in any city in the United States, right? These sorts of things, which draw the ire of people who aren't fans of the team or who don't follow the sport and therefore only hear these names every 4 years and say, oh, there goes Megan Rapinoe. It's always Megan Rapinoe. There goes Megan Rapinoe with her sunglasses, her hair. It's blue now. What is this haircut? Why is she dancing after she played 2 minutes in an elimination game against Portugal that they narrowly scraped by a post, right? Like, these are the sorts of things where it's like, I only hear about you every 4 years and now I have a chance to it. Like a presidential election. If there's a candidate who runs every 4 years and you only hear about them for their silliest moments, you're going to write them off the second they say something similarly in caliber. And unfortunately, we're going back to that parallel between the news division and the sports division. Maybe there is some continuity in perception. Maybe there is some continuity in the audience's interest. Maybe these are the storylines that viewers who are tuning in to Fox entities want to hear. And if that's what their market research is telling them, no wonder this is how they're talking about it. But if they're coming at it from anything to do with the sport, anything to do with U.S. soccer at a macro level, it is not recognizable to what I would say is the general tone of U.S. soccer, the tone of its media corps, the people who are actually boots on the ground asking the questions of the coaches and the players, both in Australia and New Zealand and in the domestic circles around the National Women's Soccer League. These just are not the way that we are thinking about this team. Admittedly, we're thinking about soccer. We're thinking about the sport. And it just doesn't seem like there is that overlap in the coverage. And to your point, I completely agree. It seems like they were almost begging for this team to fail just so they had something to talk about.
I mean, is coaching the ultimate fall guy here? I mean, he can't fire 11 females on the team. I mean, I guess you could cut them eventually. But I mean, is that the easy guy? I mean, was coaching the issue here? Because, I mean, it sounded like there had been issues even before, you know, they arrived in New Zealand.
Yeah, there were issues in the Olympics that resurfaced, specifically in terms of prioritizing veteran status and past performance over present form, and not necessarily choosing your best team for the moment, but almost rewarding players for consistency in past years, which ultimately...
It's tough, though, because you got to get eyeballs on it. You got to sell jerseys. I mean, not that that's the front of mind, but, you know, I mean, why would anyone not want to watch, you know, Alex Morgan out there, you know, at any given moment?
Yeah, totally. And it is an entertainment business. And I know that, like, international sports where you're talking about Olympics and World Cups are always a little bit different than a club, right? It's not necessarily the same marketability because ultimately it is rooted in one nation versus another nation, right? The whole idea of international sports was founded on this principle, right? You know this better than I do. So in that sense, then, maybe you try to discourage some of that line of thought and say, look, if Alex Morgan is not the best striker that the U.S. women has on offer these days, maybe she should not be the starting striker for the United States every single game, playing every single minute, forcing the best striker in the pool, Sophia Smith, 22-year-old. She missed the penalty, of course, in the shootout, but she'll be back. She'll be around the program for years to come. Maybe put her in a spot to succeed instead of putting her out of position where she is trying to do something on the fly she has not had to do for years at this point of her career, and setting her up for a worse performance than she would have had if she was playing the role she's best at. And this is where the coaching comes into play. There were a lot of players, Sophia Smith chief among them, Crystal Dunn, one of the best midfielders in the pool playing as a left back, Julie Ertz, a trusted midfielder playing as a center back for the first time in 8 years, Emily Fox, a left back by trade playing right back. I mean, I could go through the entire team and where they played and where they usually play with the club, and it will be over half of the players who took the field for the United States, not counting the ones who didn't get a minute, who were not playing in the position that they're used to. They were having to relearn their training on a fly. And you just can't imagine that. You can't imagine that in a different sport, saying like Alex Rodriguez was a great, I mean, bad example because he played two positions, right? But like, you truly can't comprehend like telling a swimmer, like, look, you qualified for this team on what you did in freestyle, but we're just going to make you swim butterfly.
Yeah.
And you're a good swimmer. You'll figure it out. Of course, you've done butterfly in your past career. You're going to have, you know, good events and you'll be okay. And sometimes I'm sure some of this stuff has to happen, but you have specialists for a reason. You have swimmers who are good at specific events for a reason so that they can qualify and they can compete at the highest level in their event. And these players weren't playing in their event. They weren't playing in their positions. And that is something that past coaches wouldn't do to nearly the extent of Vlatko Andonovski. There was a lot of issues in terms of rotation. Players were tired. Players were overplayed. There were a lot of players who were supposed to be on the roster for big moments who just didn't see the field at all, or didn't see the field until that last penalty kick shootout, like Christy Mew as a midfielder, or Kelly O'Hara, who came off the bench 1 minute before the shootout. Things like that.
Is the criticism fair then? I mean, would he be a fall guy in this case, or just one piece of something much larger?
I think he's the one with the most tangible, direct impact. And I think that the fact that these were repeated mistakes to what we saw in Tokyo in 2021, where, again, players were playing out of position, veterans were prioritized, players weren't getting rotated adequately, given the condensed strain of a tournament like a World Cup and like an Olympics, those same mistakes came through again and again in both of these tournaments. And so I think it is very fair to say it is the coach. I would be, frankly, shocked if he's retained for another cycle. If he is coaching at the Olympics next summer, for example, it would be a massive surprise to just about everyone around the program. It is a situation where, you know, we talk about the players. The players are obviously the faces on the field that are most recognizable, but this is one where the coach made the biggest mistake of the tournament over and over again.
And it's this constant what if, right? Like, first of all, what if the ball doesn't hit the post and goes in, and you know, U.S. loses to Portugal. Right. What if they do notch one in? They don't have to play Sweden in the first round or in the knockout round, get a little bit of confidence. And, you know, we're not having this conversation. We're having a conversation about the next opponent. So I just, you know, it's tough because, you know, any little split second, and that's what's so great and beautiful about soccer is you never know when that moment's going to come. But did you feel, I know I felt, and part of it was because, like, I felt like we had been primed, but as soon as you saw that draw against Sweden, it's like, oh no.
Yeah, oh, not again.
Here we go. And then you flip on, and if you weren't watching the whole thing, it's like, all right, 0-0. Ah, now we're going into penalty kicks. Like, anything could happen here. And like, I wasn't surprised at that point. I'm like, well, that's how it goes. That's you don't put a ball in the goal and you go to penalty kicks, this is what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. I think it did match the form the team showed throughout the tournament. It's what we saw against the Netherlands, where the only time that the team really looked like they were locked in was right after their captain got in a shoving match with another player. And then that player ends up scoring a goal, and it led to 5 great minutes thereafter where the U.S. looked like they were going to win the game. And then they settled back into their game state, what they were told to do by the coach. Their tactical identity was one that was much more passive. It made it harder to look for those moments of excitement. Like, if you think about 2019, they put 13 goals past an opponent. And you can talk about the disparity in quality. And there was this whole other thing to go back to media narratives about celebrations. And do you celebrate goals in a World Cup? Right. Things like that. There was no chance for that to happen because this team was coached to be dependable, consistent, not flashy necessarily, and not putting too much pressure on any one player, rather spreading the pressure to perform evenly across all 10 field players and the goalkeeper. And you can say that, that's obviously more tactically sound. You don't want to have a situation where what Argentina on the men's side had been dealing with up until this last World Cup, where if Lionel Messi wasn't carrying the team, they weren't going to win a thing. And they didn't win a thing with him until this World Cup, where they finally got a more cohesive structure. So there is a counterexample to this, right? Obviously that has worked. But to your point, for the US, once they hadn't gotten past that hurdle with the Netherlands and only barely cleared it, once they weren't able to finally flip the switch against Portugal, Sweden was the worst opponent they could have drawn, because that is a program that is never going to be afraid of the United States women's national team, because they meet in every tournament and they play them close in every tournament. So they have enough background, enough history, both the players on the roster and their predecessors, to point and say, look, I know it's the United States. You're Sweden. You can take them too. Right. And so there was never going to be that sort of mental edge of, OK, well, the U.S. is in the knockouts now. They're going to wake up. Sweden didn't let them wake up. So, I mean, it was a matchup that narratively was a perfect opponent for this moment. It was exactly the opponent who should have been the ones to eliminate the United States before the semifinal for the first time in a Women's World Cup ever. It was an earned moment for them that a draw fortuitously handed them. But I think I agree. I think as soon as that game went on, as it got to extra time and it was still 0-0, some of that dread does come into play, and some of it just feels like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is an awful take, and I might end up deleting this, but I mean, does the money have anything to do with it? They were fighting for a contract, right? In 2019, they had to prove themselves. And, you know, I hate to use the phrase fat and happy now, but was the edge not there? Is that possible?
I think that the reality is they would have needed to put so much focus towards being social advocates, towards being in courtrooms, towards being in picket lines, organizing protests, putting together statements that have nothing to do about their day jobs, they would have inevitably had some energy which would have gone otherwise towards preparing for this tournament end up going elsewhere. And of course, because they were the first nation to pull this off, as we get into the prelude of this tournament and the rosters announced, I remember press conferences from that day, players were being asked about what do you think of the rest of the world and other nations like Spain and Jamaica and Colombia and Brazil and France that are all having these issues with their federations in this tournament. What do you think of that? And so it's still on their mind. They are still the experts on equal pay. And so part of their job always will be advocating for the growth of the game, things that they shouldn't have to fight for, things that should be inherently recognized as important, investing in your program, enabling your players, setting them up in a way to succeed and not to have to overcome hurdle after hurdle after hurdle by staying in Motel 6 right before an Olympic qualifying match, right? Things like that should be second nature. They are second nature on the men's side, and they have had to spend a big portion of the last 4 years fighting for that. Now, I think that when you talk about the money, there is still more prize money to be won in a men's World Cup than a women's World Cup. And the way that this was split, it was going to take a very far run for it to be like they were the breadwinners of the program, so to speak, as they're splitting the money evenly at the end of the day. Did it hurt them? I don't think the players in this program are necessarily purely chasing fat bank accounts.
They're not on right. The field worrying about the money at all. But you always hear these, you know, the baseball player who's you know, hitting 50 home runs a season and then gets the big contract and all of a sudden, you know. So it's always a conversation.
It's compelling. Yeah. It is compelling. And I think it is a very real necessary part of context of this 4 year cycle is that the biggest accomplishment they had nothing to do with kicking a ball. Yeah. And I think if they'd won the World Cup, you could argue that. But at the end of the day, like what they achieved in this cycle wasn't an Olympics. It wasn't a World Cup. It wasn't a silver medal in either, certainly not a gold. It was moving the game forward, moving women's athletics forward, moving the financial distribution between men's and women's athletics to a more equitable space. All of these sorts of things are very important, but that is not going to insulate them from you lost in the round of 16. Usually you make it at least to the final four. What's happening here? Those questions are not going to stop at all just because they're earning more money. But yeah, I think it is just fair to point it out and say that this did take some of their focus away over the last 4 years. And that is another situation where U.S. soccer as a federation upstairs in your building may have let them down by forcing them to put in so much work and fighting them so much in court and actually having a court writing. There was something that one of the former presidents of the federation had basically written in saying that women should not be paid as much as men because they are not athletically as gifted. Saying that, like, because of physiology, because of their muscles, because of the way that their bodies move, they cannot be as good at sports as men, and therefore they don't deserve to get paid as much. He lost his job very quickly, needless to say. But that was the sort of stuff they were fighting from, not just from the media, not just from people who were talking heads at a desk who used to play for the team. That's their own federation. Sure. That's their own leadership. How are you going to come back from that and just blindly throw it behind you and say, you know what, I feel like I have the support of my country? I don't know if there was ever a tournament where they were less emboldened by their own leadership than the two tournaments we saw, both in Tokyo in 2021 when they're in the middle of this and on the other side of this in the 2023 Women's World Cup.
Interesting. All right, so let's talk about this next 11 months then. What are we thinking? Different roster, different coaching? Mm-hmm. I mean, something's got to change. I mean, the expectation's got to be gold, right? It can't be anything below gold.
Yeah, it is. I think it's simply a matter of show people this is a blip. Don't let people think that this is... don't build pressure on the next tournament. The idea is always take the pressure off the next tournament because you accomplished something in this one, right? And so, gold. I think you're absolutely right. I think it will be a new coach. I'm sure that they won't really start in earnest interviewing candidates till after this World Cup concludes, because they will be scouring some candidates who are coaching programs in this tournament field right now. The coach of England, for example, Serena Weigman, would be a very good appointment. Helped England win its first major trophy in decades at the Euros last summer, a competition between all of the European national teams. So someone like that would be really good. They understand the international game better, the nuances of it. They could set their team up better to succeed in that format rather than having someone who's trying to run it like a club and assuming that they'll be able to get the same results as if they were training 11 months of the year every single day. And then with the players, there are some key players who are missing.
Rapinoe's gone,
Swanson.
Right? Rapinoe
Rapinoe's retired. Julie Ertz has basically said, there's a chance. There's a chance that she would still be there, but I would.
Julie Ertz?
Ertz is retiring. She alluded to it after the game, basically said that she is unlikely to. Alyssa Nair, goalkeeper, very likely to be phased out over the next 4 years. We'll see if it's before the Olympics or if it's afterward. But that does mean there will be young players who are having to step up. Mallory Swanson was injured, torn patellar tendon in the final scrimmage before this tournament in April against Ireland. You would expect that she will be starting on the left wing. Katarina Macario, a young midfielder, missed the tournament with an ACL tear. She would also be at the heart of that team. Rose Lavelle hopefully is back to 100% and able to play more regularly than she was at the start of the tournament, certainly, and then obviously missed the Sweden game with a suspension. You need to develop your defenders better. You need to have a clearer sense of what you're doing with your back line. You need to have true center backs playing and not just midfielders who are moonlighting as center backs as a like kind of an emergency option after spending the entire cycle not trying that once. You just need more cohesion. You need players to be confident that they know what they're getting into, know what they're supposed to be doing on the field and who they'll be playing alongside. And you need younger players. You just need to give those chances to the players who had earned it with their performances for their teams, their clubs in the NWSL and beyond, and actually give them the opportunity to see whether or not they're able to help a United States women's national team win a gold medal in an Olympics.
I mean, they got a year, right? They got a year to make us forget all about everything. So I guess the opportunity is there. Right. You know, we'll just see if we'll see how it goes.
We'll see. That's all we have left.
We'll see what
now.
The people on the 12th floor here want to do.
That's right.
But you think as soon as this World Cup is over, there's going to be some shifting.
Yeah, there will be. I think that I'm a little surprised they haven't announced a coaching change yet, just because it seems so written in the stars at this point. But I'm sure that part of it is just give some time for the dust to settle, and not be too like, we're doing this because you failed, but do it in a little more of an amicable way. That's usually how US soccer likes to work. But yeah, I would imagine there will be changes imminent from this decision.
Yeah, where can we follow you?
Twitter or X or whatever they call it this week, at Jeff Reuter, R-U-E-T-E-R. And then everything that I do is over on The Athletic.
Now, both the men's and women's U.S. national soccer teams have qualified for the 2024 Olympics. For the men, it's the first time since 2008. The FIBA World Cup will get underway in less than 2 weeks. It'll be held in the Philippines. Steve Kerr will lead his team of NBA players into some exhibition games heading into that tournament, which is a qualifying tournament for the Olympics. This isn't a team loaded with LeBron James, James Harden, and Steph Curry. The FIBA World Cup doesn't draw as much interest from the superstars and is one of the reasons the U.S. comes into the tournament actually ranked second. They actually finished seventh in this tournament in 2019 before winning gold in Tokyo. The U.S. roster consists of Anthony Edwards, Bobby Portis, and Jaren Jackson Jr., among others. There are plenty of other NBAers on the 32 other squads as well. We'll stay on top of that tournament once it gets going. In France, there are concerns over the water quality of the Seine River ahead of the open water swimming competition there. Officials had to cancel an open water test event because the water quality didn't meet standards. That despite a 1 billion euro effort to clean up the waterway. Now some are wondering if there's enough time to get the water ready to go for the Paris Games. Officials are blaming flooding runoff for the substandard quality. That does it for this week's episode of Quest for Gold. We've got more athletes, topics, and updates coming up for you next week. I'm Ryan Burrell. We'll see you then.